KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
As tariffs on foreign countries go up, taxes on American workers and families will come down very substantially.
Trump spent his campaign promising tariffs, and today it's happening. Will it have the effect he wants?
For Wednesday, April 2nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, Trump says he wants to be known as the fertilization president.
Not like agriculture. Fertilization as in making babies.
50-hour work weeks are highly sterilizing. If we want to see more babies, we should really be thinking about expanding remote work options, not reducing them.
Also, the latest on detained Columbia University student Mahmoud Khalil.
A judge has sided with his lawyers, saying the case should be heard in New Jersey, not Louisiana.
We basically wrote, over the course of 8 hours, a habeas petition that we submitted at, like, I think it was like 4:14 in the morning.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Laying out a litany of grievances against tariffs charged by other countries against U.S. imports, President Donald Trump presented his own retaliatory tariffs today. Speaking at the White House Rose Garden, Trump predicting that the levies, quote, will bring American factories roaring back. The tariffs against countries including India, China, Japan, and the European Union range from a 10% baseline to 50%, depending on what those countries charge the U.S.
I will sign a historic executive order instituting reciprocal tariffs on countries throughout the world. Reciprocal, that means they do it to us and we do it to them. Very simple. Can't get any simpler than that.
Trump said companies that build their products in the U.S. will face no tariffs. Many economists, meanwhile, have said raising tariffs on goods imported by other countries will result in higher prices for U.S. consumers. Trump also said 25% tariffs against cars imported into the U.S. will take effect after midnight. President Trump said he was standing up for skilled workers and farmers today, but as NPR's Frank Morris with KCUR reports, farmers are expressing concerns about the new import taxes.
Many farmers say they've been losing money recently. They're paying much more for things like fertilizer, seed, and equipment, and they're getting less for the crops they produce. Kansas farmer Vance Emke says President Trump's import taxes will make things worse.
These tariffs are just absolutely bad news. There is no good news about them whatsoever. The price for everything that we buy goes up, and the price for everything that we sell goes down.
American row crop farmers depend on exports to make a living. Emke fears that the countries they sell to, like China, Mexico, and Canada, will slap tariffs on U.S. farm exports and drive commodity prices lower. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
The federal court is ordering the Trump administration to continue to fund legal services for unaccompanied minors in immigration proceedings. NPR's Sahrio Martinez Beltran reports.
In her decision this week, California federal judge Araceli Martinez Holguin temporarily restored the legal aid for the young migrants while the case continues. The plaintiffs in the case are nonprofit legal services providers from across the country who help unaccompanied minors understand their rights and represent them in immigration proceedings. They argue that the Trump administration's decision to end funding for legal services puts 26,000 children without a parent or legal guardian in the U.S. at risk of losing their lawyers. They also claim the move is a violation of the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. The Trump administration says taxpayers should not foot the bill for these services. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
Another volatile day on Wall Street as stocks were whipsawed ahead of the Trump tariff announcement. Still, all three of the major U.S. stock indexes closed higher. The Dow rose 235 points. The Nasdaq was up 151 points today. This is NPR. A couple of Florida special House races and a Wisconsin judgeship race may be flashing some early warning signals for Republicans and the Trump administration. While Florida Republicans held on to two of the most pro-Trump districts of the country, they significantly underperformed Trump's November margins. And in Wisconsin, despite the administration's backing and millions spent by Trump advisor Elon Musk, a conservative candidate for the state Supreme Court was defeated by a liberal Democrat. Wisconsin is a state Trump won in November. a pair of baby eagles in the mountains east of Los Angeles that star on 24/7 live stream now have names. People from around the world submitted more than 50,000 suggestions for what the eaglet should be called. Member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Ahmed has more.
The winning names for the eaglets are Sunny for the bigger one and Gizmo for the smaller one. They're both just under a foot tall. Sandy Steers, who operates the live stream, organized the eaglet naming. She narrowed down the list of 50,000 suggestions to 30 and let local elementary school students near the nest in Big Bear select the two winners.
I think they're fun, and I like that the kids, so many of them, voted for the same name.
Steers says the next milestone for Sunny and Gizmo is flight. That could be as soon as mid-May. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ahmed in San Bernardino.
Officials in Vienna are calling it an unprecedented discovery, intertwined skeletal remains, what they say appears to be a mass grave dating back to the Roman Empire. They say the grave from the first century contains the bodies of 129 fighters. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Just after the stock markets closed today, President Trump announced broad new tariffs on all imports and even higher ones for countries that have a lot of trade barriers.
In short, chronic trade deficits are no longer merely an economic problem. They're a national emergency that threatens our security and our very way of life. It's a very great threat to our country.
Trump calls them reciprocal tariffs and has declared this to be Liberation Day for the U.S. economy, but experts warn that aggressive new tariffs could tank the U.S. economy and burden consumers with higher prices. Senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith is following this. Hey, Tam.
Hi.
Let's jump straight into the details. What did President Trump announce?
Starting Saturday, almost every item imported into the U.S. will be hit with at least a 10% tariff. On top of that, starting a week from now, a long list of countries with higher barriers to trade will face even higher tariffs. Take Vietnam, a country where a lot of American companies moved manufacturing after Trump put tariffs on China in his first term. According to a chart that Trump held up at his Rose Garden event, products coming into the U.S. from Vietnam would face a tariff of 46%. Another thing to note is that this is very likely not the end of the story. President Trump has previously said that he's open to negotiation, so the actual tariff load could end up changing over time. But he said the best way to avoid tariffs is for companies to bring their operations to the United States, something that cannot happen overnight.
What does the president say these tariffs will accomplish?
He says he thinks this will boost U.S. manufacturing, bring down the trade deficit, and bring in revenue to the Treasury to pay for a tax cut that he wants Congress to pass this year. He says it will transform the country.
We will supercharge our domestic industrial base. We will pry open foreign markets and break down foreign trade barriers. And ultimately, more production at home will mean stronger competition and lower prices for consumers.
But most economists warn that these tariffs will ultimately hike consumer prices. Importers in the U.S. pay them, not foreign countries, and they'll pass them on to Americans buying the products. And some countries are already threatening retaliation that could hit farmers and other key U.S. industries that rely on exports. So this is a risky economic bet. Trump acknowledged that there is a lot of skepticism about this plan, but he insists that the strong economy in his first term is proof that he is right and all the experts and doubters are wrong.
What about the voters? Is this likely to be popular with Americans?
The president called up a retired auto worker at this event to the microphone who praised the move. He credits blue-collar workers in the Midwest with his win in November. And the power of tariffs is a core belief for Trump going back at least to the 1980s. He campaigned on this very policy, including a rather crude description of reciprocal tariffs he delivered at a rally in South Carolina last February.
It's called You Screw Us and We Screw You. Very simple. As tariffs on foreign countries go up, taxes on American workers and families will come down very substantially.
So, as he boasted today, promises made, promises kept. This is what he talked about in the campaign. But there are real warning signs for the president here. Recent polls indicate overall Americans have significant concerns with the president's focus on tariffs. A Fox News poll released over the weekend found 69% of people believe tariffs will make the products they buy more expensive. Trump has already predicted there could be short-term pain in the economy. So if this doesn't work out, or if it takes too long, he and his party could suffer the political consequences.
And NPR's Tamara Keith joining us from the White House. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ari.
The NFL announced this week that it will use a high-tech system of cameras in the upcoming season to track the ball down the field and determine whether a team gets a first down. Sony's Hawkeye system will be installed in all 30 NFL stadiums, and the NFL says it'll save time over the traditional chain measurements, though they do say that the chain crew will stay on the field as a backup. Now, Hawkeye already has a long history with other sports like tennis, cricket, soccer, and rugby, and Kevin Nguyen at The Verge has written about it. Hey there.
How's it going?
I am doing well. So, Kevin, I know that you went to a tennis match where Hawkeye was in use, and you went up to this sort of command center that's called the Hawkeye Nest. Give us the view from there. How does this all work?
Yeah, basically they have a, maybe pun intended, a bird's eye view of the match, and it's just a bunch of nerds at a bunch of computers. They're all like in their 20s. And what's kind of fun is like they are in charge of the integrity of, you know, all the important things that are happening on the court.
So one question that I have as a big sports fan is whether or not Hawkeye really is more accurate than traditional measurements. I mean, I think we've all seen and remember those sort of controversial calls. I wonder if this will reduce conflict between players and refs and all those disagreements that we might see.
Yeah, I mean, in tennis especially, there's just a lot of evidence that Hawkeye is a lot more reliable than the human eye. Traditionally, for, you know, 100 years, line judges were used to call balls in and out in tennis, and oftentimes they were quite wrong. So, you know, all of the tests have shown that Hawkeye is much more reliable, and players really like it, too. Players trust Hawkeye more than they trust the line judges, and maybe the more important thing is you can't really yell at a technology system the way you can yell at a chair umpire.
Yeah, so I was looking at the NFL's press release when they announced this change, and they pointed out that Hawkeye partners with like 23 of the top 25 global sports leagues. I mean, that's so many sports that are using this technology. How did it get its start?
I mean, people associate Hawkeye with tennis because the technology is publicly called Hawkeye there, but Hawkeye isn't nearly anything you watch. It was founded by this guy named Paul Hawkins, so he kind of named it after himself, Hawkeye.
Uh-huh.
And originally it was made for cricket, but he found it much more applicable to tennis and just got a lot more pickup there. And the way the Hawkeye system works in tennis, it's 12 cameras that are positioned around the court. Only 8 are used at a time. 4 of them are actually backups in case of any failure. And they basically just triangulates where the ball is headed. So not only is it tracking players, the net, the ball, but it's actually trying to measure through math, like how the ball is going to hit the court. So it's kind of predicting actually through physics where the ball is going to land. And it just works quite well.
Interesting. So aside from producing measurements that help officials call the game, are there other ways that Hawkeye has changed the game of tennis for people who are either watching in person or watching the games on their TV?
Yeah, Hawkeye actually started implemented in tennis as a broadcast enhancement, so people watching at home could see where the ball landed. But it wasn't an official measurement, so it's not like the chair umpire or any line judges had access to what Hawkeye was seeing. So there was this kind of funny disconnect where at home you actually had more information than the people on the court. So eventually they started rolling out Hawkeye as a challenge system. So if a player believed that a line judge had gotten a call wrong, which they do somewhat frequently, a player had a number of challenges and they put their finger in the air, and that would activate Hawkeye. And then everyone, the player, the line judges, and then everyone in the audience would watch this kind of this slow motion animation would pop up and then slowly reveal the exact placement of the ball in the court, whether it was in or out. So it had actually a lot of great drama back in the day.
Kevin Nguyen is Deputy Features Editor at The Verge. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Democratic New Jersey Senator Cory Booker took the Senate podium Monday night at 7 p.m. and spoke for more than 25 hours about the state of American politics. He ended his marathon address, the longest Senate speech on record, with these words.
This is a moral moment. It's not left or right. It's right or wrong.
And then he quoted his mentor, the late Congressman and civil rights activist John Lewis.
It's getting good trouble. My friend, Madam President, I yield the floor.
Booker's extended speech reminded film critic Bob Mondello of a movie senator who once did much the same thing.
His voice is ragged, hair unkempt, eyes bleary, but in the 1939 classic Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart is on a tear.
A man who controls a political machine and controls everything else worth controlling in my state. Yes, and a man even powerful enough to control congressmen, and I saw three of them in his room the day I went up to see him.
Will the senator yield?
No, sir, I will not yield.
25 hours he went on, arguing for decency and the American way, arguing against political corruption, arguing until he could barely speak.
There's no place out there for graft, or greed, or lies, or compromise with human liberties. Great principles don't get lost once they come to light. They're right here. You just have to see them again.
The Senate wouldn't listen, and in the film, the public didn't even get a chance to listen because the corrupt politicians had the press in their pocket, and still, he kept going.
I guess this is just another lost cause, Mr. Payne. All you people don't know about lost causes. Mr. Payne does. He said once they were the only causes worth fighting for. And he fought for them once. For the only reason any man ever fights for them. Because of just one plain, simple rule. Love thy neighbor.
I remember learning in my 7th grade civics class about how Congress worked, but I didn't really get the concept of a filibuster until I saw Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. The movie played on TV when I was a kid, and it was clear to me even then that filmmaker Frank Capra had made his title character both principled and naive. Mr. Smith is right about corruption, but by the time the bad guy's confessing, he's passed out on the Senate floor, and the film ends not with glory for Mr. Smith, but with chaos and the President of the Senate smiling to himself. Capra was no fool. One man standing up against the system is just one man. The system will survive, but the standing up, that is what audiences took to heart. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Supreme Court seemed closely divided today in a case testing whether states can remove Planned Parenthood clinics from state Medicaid programs, even though Medicaid cannot generally be used to fund abortions. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Under the Medicaid law, the federal government provides the lion's share of Medicaid funding for all 50 states, and in exchange, the states must meet a variety of requirements. One of those is that Medicaid patients are entitled to choose their doctors. In the words of the statute, they're entitled to treatment from, quote, any qualified and willing provider. In South Carolina, that includes Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, which provides low-income patients with many run-of-the-mill services from cancer screenings to full physical exams. But in 2018, the state's Republican governor issued executive orders terminating Planned Parenthood from participating in the Medicaid program. Those orders were repeatedly blocked by the lower courts, prompting South Carolina to appeal. Today, the question before the Supreme Court was whether individuals can go to court at all to vindicate their right to choose their doctors under the Medicaid law. Lawyer John Bursch, representing South Carolina, argued that the Medicaid statute does not use the word right or its functional equivalent, and thus individuals have no right to sue to enforce the choice of doctor provision. Justice Kagan wasn't buying that argument.
The state has an obligation to ensure that a person, I don't even know how to say this line without saying right, has a right to choose their doctor.
Kagan noted that Congress specifically amended the Medicaid law to ensure the freedom to choose one's doctor under Medicaid.
That's what this provision is. It's impossible to even say the thing without using the word right.
Justice Barrett asked what recourse she would have if she wanted to see Dr. Jones, a fully qualified provider, but the state wouldn't cover the charges because Dr. Jones was at Planned Parenthood. Couldn't she sue to enforce her choice of physician?
You're depriving me of my ability to see the provider of my choice.
Lawyer Bursch replied that patients don't have a, quote, magic wand allowing them to pick their doctor. Representing Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, lawyer Nicole Saharsky told the justices that Congress clearly established an individual right in the law, a right that the state cannot abridge and that an individual may sue to enforce. Questioned by Justice Alito about the potential for a flood of lawsuits, she pointed to the dozens and dozens of provisions imposed on the state under the Medicaid law, and she noted that only 8 or 9 of them are by law enforceable by individuals, yet none has led to a flood of lawsuits. From there, she pivoted to a different point, the state's contention that the any qualified provider provision of the Medicaid law has led to lawyers gobbling up legal fees or patients somehow profiting from these lawsuits.
It's wrong to suggest that individuals on Medicaid are seeking some kind of financial benefit.
They're not seeking money damages, she said. All they want is a court order allowing for Planned Parenthood, a qualified Medicaid provider, to remain in the state where it has operated for decades.
These aren't people getting rich. They're just trying to get health care.
If the Supreme Court rules for the state of South Carolina in this case, Planned Parenthood would likely have to close its doors in the state, and the ripple effects would be profound, spreading to many other states where politicians have long tried to make it impossible for Planned Parenthood to provide non-abortion services. If, on the other hand, the court rules in favor of Planned Parenthood, it can continue to provide non-abortion services for low-income people and be reimbursed by Medicaid for most of the cost. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Here in Washington, D.C., spring has really sprung, which means it's perfect weather to sit on a blanket in the grass and read, at least until the mosquitoes arrive. NPR's Andrew Limbong hosts our Book of the Day podcast, and he is here with some spring fiction recommendations. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Ari.
Spring can be romantic, couples holding hands under the cherry blossoms. You want to kick us off with your favorite romance title?
All right, if we're looking for something, you know, light and airy and fun, Mia Sosa has got a novel coming out in June titled When Javi Dumped Mari. If that title reminds you of When Harry Met Sally, that's not an accident. When Javi Dumped Mari is a classic, you know, friends to lovers rom-com about two best friends who, you know, are just friends, and they definitely don't have any romantic chemistry between the two of them until Mari decides to get engaged to another guy. The author, Mia Sosa, she's just a pro at these cute and fun rom-com books, a perfect spring, early summer vibes.
Okay, you said the title of that one takes a cue from When Harry Met Sally. Is there any chance you've got another book on your list that also is inspired by a classic movie?
Yeah.
What are the chances? Amazing.
Yeah, what are the chances? Golly. That'd be King of Ashes by S.A. Cosby. That's a Southern crime drama inspired by The Godfather. You know, there's an ailing patriarch, a family that's falling apart, and a son who has to come back and pull everything together. Cosby is one of the biggest names in contemporary crime right now. His last book, All the Sinners Bleed, I think was kind of a breakthrough for him. You know, he got this gushing review in the New York Times. The review is written by a Stephen King.
Yeah, I heard of him.
And who called Cosby's attention to detail, quote, fresh and exhilarating. This new book comes out in June, and according to the Hollywood Trades, it's already being turned into a TV series on Netflix, so it's a good time to get in early on it.
Okay, those are a couple of experienced writers. Any new authors' debuts that you've got your eye on?
There's this book called Among Friends that's coming out. It's by Hal Ebbett. It's about these two families who've been friends for decades. The dads in particular, Amos and Emerson, were roommates in college, and they both have daughters around the same age. They get drinks and have dinners, and it's all very picturesque. Of course, it would be a pretty boring book if it stayed like that. So there's the usual petty jealousies and resentment you get with any long-term relationship. But there's also, I obviously won't spoil it, but there's a big act of betrayal that throws everything apart. I think I just want to shout out the writing style. Ebbett's writing style in this, he seems really interested in craft. We've been talking about movies a lot, and I think his writing feels cinematic, even if it's just, you know, middle-class people being passive-aggressive to each other.
Cool. Well, I personally am not a parent, but if I wanted to live vicariously through them in fiction...
I don't know if you do.
I hear you've got a couple parenting titles for us.
Sort of. Let's start with the one that's more out there. Vanishing World is the new novel by Japanese writer Sayaka Murata, translated by Jenny Tapley Takamori. Murata is known for strange, quirky fiction, and this one is more sci-fi. It's set in a Japan where the norm is for children to be conceived through artificial insemination, and it starts with this girl who finds out with a shock and horror that she was conceived via sex. Now, jump ahead a few decades, and she decides to live with her husband in this experimental commune where all the children are raised by all the adults, so it completely dissolves what we might think of as like a quote-unquote like family unit. Like I said, Murata is known for weirdness, and she's using her weirdness here to like ask questions about sex and love and family.
Not sure I want to live vicariously through that one. What's the other one?
I don't know if this one will be any better. It's by Katie Kitamura. It's called Audition.
Oh, yeah, I read this. Don't want to live vicariously through this one either.
Yeah, so as you know, it comes out next week. It starts with this woman who's having lunch with a younger man, and the man believes the woman to be his mother. I won't really spoil it, but I don't know about you. I feel like it's giving a little like psychological thriller.
Totally. Right? I felt like it was about to become a horror book, but it never did.
Yeah, and it's really asking these questions about family, right? And if just like acting or pretending to be a family is enough.
And we're going to have an interview with the author, Katie Kitamura, on All Things Considered later. So stay tuned for that. NPR's Andrew Limbong, host of our Book of the Day podcast. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
This is NPR News. Tariffs are central to President Donald Trump's economic plans. Now, as markets and manufacturers brace for another round of them, the ripple effects are unclear.
It's simple. If you make your product in America, you will pay no tariffs.
We get reactions from around the world tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, people who use food assistance react to the health secretary's move to limit some of the products they can buy, like soda.
I feel more dignity. I feel more secure in who I am having options, which then makes me a better mom and better mental health. Like, it's all connected.
Now this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Speaking from the White House Rose Garden this afternoon, President Trump announced a sweeping plan to apply a 10% tariff beginning at midnight on all imports coming into the U.S. The president also had a list of 60 countries he said will face reciprocal tariffs as high as 49% starting April 9th. Trump says the move will boost U.S. businesses.
We will supercharge our domestic industrial base. We will pry open foreign markets and break down foreign trade barriers. And ultimately, more production at home will mean stronger competition and lower prices for consumers.
It's perhaps the most aggressive changes to U.S. trade policy in decades. That's sure to result in retaliatory tariffs from our key trading partners. Most economists warn that tariffs will raise prices for consumers and could hurt the economy as inflation continues to climb. New research finds the wealthiest Americans only live about as long as the poorest northern and western Europeans, despite spending more money in the U.S. on health care. NPR's Rob Stein has more on the study.
Researchers at Brown University analyzed data collected from more than 73,000 older adults in the United States and Europe between 2010 and 2022. They weren't surprised to find that the wealthiest people in both the U.S. and Europe tended to live longer than the poorest. But they were surprised by this. The wealthiest Americans didn't live as long as the most affluent Europeans and only tend to have the longevity of the poorest Western and Northern Europeans. That's despite the fact that the U.S. spends more than any other wealthy country on health care. Rob Stein, NPR News.
President Trump waited until the markets closed to announce new 25% tariffs on all foreign-made autos. This is NPR. There's new evidence that a vaccine for shingles may reduce a person's risk of developing dementia. That study, something of a reminder that the line between infectious diseases and chronic illness can be blurred, as NPR's John Hamilton reports.
The study relied on health records of people in their 70s and 80s who lived in Wales in the UK. It found that those who received a shingles vaccine were about 20% less likely than people who didn't to be diagnosed with dementia during a 7-year period. The finding adds to the evidence that viruses that affect the nervous system can increase the risk of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Shingles is caused by a herpes virus that can remain dormant in nerve cells for decades before reemerging when age or illness weakens the immune system. The same herpes virus also causes chickenpox. Researchers don't know why the vaccine appears to reduce the risk of dementia. John Hamilton, NPR News.
In Vienna, construction crews made an unprecedented discovery last year of a mass grave dating back to the first century Roman Empire. Archaeologists found the skeletal remains of what are believed to be 129 Roman-era fighters intertwined in the mass grave. Experts say the find is unparalleled in Central Europe. The Vienna Museum gave the first public presentation of the findings this week. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. One race for one seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court has Democrats claiming victory over President Trump and Elon Musk. The election was nonpartisan, but Republican and Democratic backers across the country wrote big enough checks to make it the most expensive court race in U.S. history. $100 million later, and liberals kept control of the court. Anya Van Wagtendonk is here to talk about it from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Hi there.
Hi.
What happened in this race last night?
Yeah, I'll start with the basics. It was a race between liberal judge Susan Crawford and conservative judge Brad Schimmel. They were fighting over the ideological majority on the court, which weighs in on things like abortion rights, labor law, voting law, maybe even congressional redistricting. And so that's why both had big money to spend, like you mentioned, combined of more than $100 million. But the race became especially well known after Elon Musk, one of the richest people in the world, spent more than $20 million of his own dollars for Schimmel, the conservative judge's campaign. And Crawford had heavy backing from Democrats, and she ended up winning by 10 percentage points. That is a landslide in Wisconsin, and it guarantees that liberals will control the court until at least 2028.
So that is a wide victory in Wisconsin. How did Crawford come out so far ahead?
Yeah, it was both a big win and it was called really early. Even a member of Crawford's own team told me they were preparing for a longer night than we ended up having. I spoke with Lily Gorin, a political scientist at Carroll University in Waukesha. She was also pretty surprised by how decisive that win was, and she compared Crawford's performance to that of Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris last November.
Some of the data that I have seen suggests that Crawford did better in kind of every district than Harris had done in 2024.
So Crawford did really well in traditional Democratic strongholds like Milwaukee and the capital city of Madison, but she also outperformed in areas that aren't those traditional strongholds. She even took some counties that President Donald Trump won in November. As for the how of how she did that, Ari, that's really the big question. Some people I've spoken to have described the involvement of Elon Musk as having this kind of lightning rod, kind of polarizing effect. So yes, he spent a ton of money to rev up conservative and pro-Trump voters, but that also really bothered some liberals.
Yeah, tell us more about how people are assessing Elon Musk's involvement now that the race is over.
You know, Democrats are really trying to argue that this win for Crawford is a loss for Musk. So just a kind of reminder, one out of every $5 in this race came from Musk. And it wasn't just, you know, paying for ads and billboards. He also paid people to sign a petition against, quote, activist judges. He came to Green Bay and gave away $1 million checks to voters. And Democrats, you know, didn't perform so well across the country in 2024, you may recall. But this win has Wisconsin Democrats pretty gleeful. Here's party chair Ben Wickler on a press call today.
When Elon Musk comes to town, Republicans should flee in panic. And for that reason, I hope that Elon Musk stays extremely involved in Republican politics.
But, you know, Republicans say that they are not seeing this as a referendum on Musk or on the Trump administration. The Wisconsin Republican Party is pointing to how they built out their fundraising and canvassing work in this race in support of conservative Judge Schimmel. And they say they're looking towards the 2026 midterms.
That is Anya Van Wagtendonk with Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump made an unusual prediction recently.
I'll be known as the fertilization president. That's okay. That's not bad.
That's Trump speaking during a Women's History Month event at the White House last week. Since the campaign, Trump has been touting his support for the fertility treatment known as IVF, but as NPR's Sarah McCammon reports, that position is putting him at odds with some conservatives.
Among the long list of executive orders President Trump has signed so far, there's one focused on an issue that's not a traditional priority for Republicans.
Fertilization. I've been saying that we're going to do what we have to do, and I think the women and families, husbands, are very appreciative of it.
That's Trump in February when he signed an executive order focused on expanding access to in vitro fertilization. Trump has been staking out his support for the fertility treatment for more than a year.
I strongly support the availability of IVF for couples who are trying to have a precious little beautiful baby. I support it.
That's Trump campaigning in South Carolina early last year after an Alabama Supreme Court decision prompted fertility clinics there to temporarily stop offering the procedure. At a time when many Republicans were worried about a voter backlash against abortion restrictions, Trump noted that IVF has overwhelming public support. Now, as president, he's directed administration officials to prepare a list of ideas for expanding access and reducing costs.
It's a good first start.
Barbara Calora of Resolve, the National Infertility Association, notes that during the campaign, Trump promised either public funding or mandated insurance coverage for IVF.
This executive order does not do that in and of itself. It is asking for policy recommendations. So as far as we're concerned, it's a first step.
Calora is calling on the administration to offer comprehensive coverage for military service members and mandated coverage in health plans offered to federal employees, among other recommendations. Trump's push for expanded IVF coverage is getting some pushback from conservatives normally aligned with Republicans. Jason Thacker is a senior fellow in bioethics at the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, or ERLC, which opposes the intentional destruction of embryos left over from IVF.
We can do a lot of things in terms of biomedical technologies, advancements, even fertility treatments. We can do a lot of things, but what we as Christians, and specifically the ERLC, are concerned about is to slow down and say, should we?
Some insurance industry leaders and some fiscal conservatives also warn that requiring insurance companies to cover IVF could increase overall health care costs. John Shelton is policy director for Advancing American Freedom, a group founded by former Vice President Mike Pence.
We just sort of see this healthcare mandate approach as probably driving up costs more, creating perverse incentives to create more embryos than are implanted.
Beyond helping individual couples conceive, both Trump and his vice president, J.D. Vance, have spoken about a desire to see more births. Here's Vance at the March for Life in Washington in January.
So let me say very simply, I want more babies in the United States of America.
In his public remarks, Trump has explicitly linked support for IVF to the goal of making it easier for American couples to have more babies. Research suggests IVF does not increase overall fertility rates. It just shifts when some people start their families, according to Lyman Stone of the Pronatalism Initiative at the Institute for Family Studies. But Stone says there's at least one thing the federal government could do differently to encourage its workers to have more children.
50-hour work weeks are highly sterilizing. So if we want to see more babies, we should really be thinking about expanding remote work options, not reducing them.
The White House says the main goal of Trump's executive order is to help couples who are struggling to conceive, not to increase the nation's birth rate. Proposals to expand IVF access are still under review. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. There's more evidence today that the United States lags behind affluent European countries in enabling people to live long, healthy lives. A big new study out today reveals a surprising new twist on this problem. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has the story.
Even though the U.S. spends way more on medical care than other affluent countries, the life expectancies of Americans have long lagged behind people in other wealthy nations. Soreen Papanicolaou of the Brown University School of Public Health and her colleagues decided to take a closer look at the relationship between wealth and health in the U.S. compared to Europe. They followed more than 73,000 adults in the U.S. and Europe between 2010 and 2022. And they were surprised by what they discovered. Sure, the richest Americans tend to live longer than the poorest Americans and Europeans, but even the richest Americans don't live as long as the richest Europeans.
The survival of the
wealthiest in the United States was better than the poorest in the United States, but comparable to the poorest in Northern and Western Europe. We were surprised by that result.
About 80% of the wealthiest Americans were still alive by the end of the study. That's only about as good as the poorest Northern and Western Europeans, and not nearly as good as the richest Northern and Western Europeans. About 90% of them survived.
You would think in this grouping that the wealthiest Americans can afford, you know, some of the best health care that the world has to offer, and the ability to access many other factors that are important for your health, such as good food, live in a relatively safe neighborhood. And so you would expect that the wealthiest in the United States have better, if not equal, mortality to the wealthiest in Northern and Western Europe.
But that's not what the data show. Now, the study didn't explain why this is the case, but Papanicolaou and others say the U.S. probably lags because of a variety of factors, like how badly many Americans eat, how little exercise they get, not to mention gun violence and stress, and how hard it can be to get health care, even for many affluent people. The new study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, comes as President Trump and his new health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., are promising to make Americans healthier by focusing on fighting chronic diseases. Other experts say that could help, but some steps the administration is taking may just make things worse. Ellen Mera is a professor of health economics and policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
Anything that's trying to lower chronic illness feels like a good thing. But to do that by dismantling the institutions that research these things seems like a strange way to go about it.
Secretary Kennedy posted on social media that the U.S. healthcare system needs an overhaul because, quote, what we've been doing isn't working. Rob Stein, NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy npr.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Immigration agents arrested Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil in New York on March 8th. They quickly moved him to New Jersey and then to Louisiana, where he remains detained. His lawyers are fighting the Trump administration's attempt to deport him over his pro-Palestinian activism. Yesterday, a federal judge made an important ruling about where his case will be heard. NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
The night ICE agents followed Khalil and his wife into the lobby of their New York apartment building, Khalil got his lawyer, Amy Greer, on the phone. She told one of the agents, "You can't arrest him. He's got a green card."
And he said, "Oh, he'll go in front of an immigration judge." And then I started demanding for a warrant. I was like, "You cannot take him until you show us a warrant." And the agent hung up on me.
But what was the first thing you did?
Cried. Truly, that's what I did. I just burst into tears.
Minutes later, Khalil's wife called Greer back. An agent had told her they were taking Khalil to a Manhattan detention facility. Greer called a colleague for help.
We're criminal defense attorneys. I'm not an immigration attorney. And so we were like, "Wait a second, I think you have to file a habeas."
A habeas corpus petition challenges someone's detention over violations of their constitutional rights. Greer had to work fast because she knew ICE would probably move Khalil out of New York, and she wanted the case to be heard there. She and several other lawyers stayed up all night.
Basically, a whole bunch of legal brains got together, and we basically wrote over the course of 8 hours a habeas petition that we submitted at, like, I think it was like 4:14 in the morning.
The case was officially filed at 4:41 that morning. But in court filings, the government said that by that time, Khalil had already been moved across the river to New Jersey. Hours later, ICE put him on a plane to Louisiana. That sequence of events teed up the huge legal fight over a crucial question. Where would Khalil's case be heard? In the New York area where his lawyers want it, or down in Louisiana where the government does?
The government believes that it has an advantage if it brings people down there.
Brett Max Kaufman with the ACLU is one of Khalil's lawyers. He says there's a real disadvantage to sending Khalil and his case to Louisiana.
When you do that, you take someone away from their community, from their family, from their lawyers. It really is a huge debilitating thing to not be able to walk into a facility and spend time with your client face to face.
Several of the other students and scholars the Trump administration has arrested alleging their pro-Palestinian activism supports terrorism have also been quickly shipped to Louisiana. ICE has 9 detention facilities in the state. The federal court system in Louisiana is one of the nation's most conservative.
What the government has been attempting to do is use its ability to move detainees around at will to avoid the jurisdiction of the courts where their lawyers filed cases.
The Department of Justice declined NPR's request for comment. In federal court, government lawyers argued that Khalil's case should be heard in Louisiana because when his lawyer filed her habeas petition, he was already in New Jersey on his way to Louisiana. But yesterday, New Jersey federal judge Michael Farbiars rejected that argument. He wrote there was no way for Khalil's lawyer to know where he was when she filed her petition in New York. He ordered the case to be heard in New Jersey. The government says it plans to appeal. The ACLU's Brett Kaufman says Amy Greer's decision to stay up all night to file her habeas claim before Khalil was put on a plane was crucial.
If she had waited even, 5 hours later, the government would be on much stronger ground to argue that there was no other place to hear the case other than Louisiana.
His lawyers call it a big win. They're now asking the judge to return Khalil to New Jersey and release him before his first child is born later this month. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants to stop Americans from buying soda, at least those who are using the federal food assistance program known as SNAP. It's unclear if Kennedy has the authority to make this change, and critics say it's not the best way to get people to eat a healthier diet. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
Among the people who are skeptical about Kennedy's proposal, Natalie Kaya, single working mom of 4. She's been on and off food assistance for over a decade. She says she has used it to buy soda.
Like, I love to once in a while treat my kids like a fun pizza night would also be soda night.
Kaya says it's a small indulgence, but it's a meaningful one.
The more choice I have, it feels, first of all, I feel more dignity. I feel more secure in who I am having options, which then makes me a better mom and better mental health. Like, it's all connected.
Some people who study food policy say it's not a bad idea to discourage people on federal assistance from consuming things like soda and candy. Dariush Mozafarian directs the Food as Medicine Institute at Tufts University. He says SNAP has been an effective program for reducing financial strain for families.
And
At the same time, it's not been a very effective program for improving nutrition. It's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and yet the N has been missing.
Mozafarian says it is important that states try new things to promote healthier eating, but he points to programs that use negative and positive incentives as the most successful. For example, giving people more money to spend on groceries when they buy fruits and vegetables.
That's a way of preserving choice, but nudging people towards healthier behaviors.
One thing most people who study food agree on, too much sugary soda does contribute to obesity and chronic disease. One study found people not on SNAP benefits drink almost the same amount as those who are.
Americans should drink less soda. No question about it.
Joel Berg is the CEO of an organization called Hunger Free America. He worked on food policy under President Clinton. He doesn't believe Kennedy's proposal is the way to make people healthier.
If we really want to improve public health, we ought to make healthier food more affordable, more physically available, and convenient.
Berg points to research from his organization that looked at the impact of the expanded child tax credit on people's shopping behavior. That credit put more money in their pockets.
We found that low-income people told us nationwide they were able to buy healthier food, they were able to shop at more farmers markets. If you build it, they will come.
Another group that's not a fan of restrictions is beverage companies. Meredith Potter is senior vice president at America Beverage. That's an industry group. She says it's a soundbite solution to a very complex problem, and it's picking on working families.
The majority of people on SNAP work. They just don't make enough to make ends meet month to month. It'll treat them like second-class citizens.
Potter says beverage companies are sensitive to concerns around sugar.
Our companies have been innovating and bringing more choices to market that have less sugar. I mean, just look at the explosion in growth in water and sparkling waters and flavored waters.
Representatives from both the Department of Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which administers SNAP, did not respond to an interview request for this story. Natalie Kaya, the mom of four, says she has a message for the administration.
There is so much more than soda that we are up against when it comes to health and being healthy and giving our children and ourselves healthy foods and drinks.
Kaya says working full-time, being a single mom of four kids, she feels like she's on a hamster wheel.
A lot of times it feels like, because I have to pay my bills and I can barely pay my bills. And so there's no time except here, let me pop up some chicken nuggets in the microwave.
She says instead of a soda ban, she could really use more time and money to make a healthy meal. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.